Hello, I'm Stephen Rumford, and this is the Life and Death Podcast, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice Care, a series in which we have honest conversations about life, death, and so much more. I've worked in palliative care for over 20 years, and in this series I talk to people who've experiences of death and dying, to try and get a deeper understanding of what life and death means to them. In today's episode, we're looking at the last year, how COVID has uniquely impacted palliative care and changed the way in which we all view death. I spoke to Dr. Becky, who is a doctor in our inpatient unit at Ashgate Hospice Care, as well as Hannah, who is a healthcare assistant here. I also checked in with listener's favourite, Roy, who was the first patient I ever spoke to for the Life and Death podcast. There was a lot to cover in this episode, but I started by finding out a bit more about Dr. Becky and her path into palliative care.
My name's Rebecca Avis. I'm one of the doctors that works here at Ashgate Hospice. I was born in Sheffield and only lived there till I was about 5 or 6, and then had a bit of a moving around the country childhood because my dad worked for the steel industry. So spent a bit of time in South Wales, then North Wales, then back to South Wales, and then came back to, saw the light and came back to Sheffield for uni. It sounds a bit weird, but I always found like illness interesting and how people kind of manage themselves when they were ill, even when I was quite young. So I'd always sort of thought that I'd quite enjoy that, but I sort of wanted to be a historian for a while. So I used to say I either want to be a historian because I like the idea of poking around, you know, castles and things like that, and reading books about historical things. So it was a bit of a toss-up between history or medicine.
So Rebecca, I wonder if I could take you back to the first lockdown as a result of COVID.
Yeah.
Can you take us back to when COVID started affecting life in the hospice, as it were, or work in the hospice?
So I kind of have this little picture in my mind, and it might just be quite inaccurate and me picking on this as some sort of little moment, but I do remember one, I think it was a Friday. In fact, I'm pretty sure it was a Friday when it was like everybody left. All of a sudden, this, I guess there was a build-up, but in my head, one afternoon, we went from a slightly bustling kind of place where, you know, we like to think we're calm and peaceful, but quite often we're not. And suddenly it was like calm and peaceful. We were told, right, okay, you know, only frontline staff who need to be here should be the only ones here. And it really did feel quite sort of slightly spooky. And then, of course, you know, alongside that slightly sort of filmic type thing, there was guideline after guideline after. Are they guidelines, Stephen?
Sort of, yeah, like standard operating yeah. Procedures.
SOP. I'd never heard that word before.
I'd never heard goodness. SOP. No, same. I thought it was like milk. I thought it was bread in milk. Yes. So SOP. Is a SOP? Is it a
something
thing?
Something that people in the Middle Ages fed their children.
Yeah, exactly. When did they become things? What was the emotion? What was the atmosphere like? I mean, you have sort of to say it was weird, and was it frightening? Was it unsettling? Was there a sense of like, what does this mean for us?
So I would probably, I don't know, did I feel frightened myself? No, I don't think I did. But unsettled, yes. The main thing for us is the patients, and, you know, they were bringing all manner of, you know, it's wicked, isn't it? It was cruel what people had to go through. I mean, Stephen, you'd have seen it with your guys as well. You know, the worry in the run-up to lockdown, you know, people with family overseas who, you know, where time is short for them, and all of a sudden, all possibility of them achieving any of the goals they had, ticking their bucket list, seeing their family member who lived overseas, just whipped away, you know, from them. So, you know, in the run-up to that spooky afternoon where everything went quiet, there was a lot of people in clinic who, you know, you'd talk about, you know, what's going on for you at the moment, and they'd say, am I stupid, but I'm really worried about this COVID. And you'd say, oh, you know, tell me a bit more about that. And it would be like, well, my son lives in Germany and, you know, will I ever see him again? And, you know, that is massive, isn't it, for people? And if you think of that, however many times, however many people we see in a week, that's a lot of distress on top of already you know, difficult circumstances, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess, you know, if you've got a life-limiting illness and then you get a you get an infection, you get a disease that is kind of characterized by the media as almost another death sentence, kind of. Yes. I mean, it isn't like, but just say the kind of 10 o'clock news thing, the kind of death figures every day, death, died. But there's almost like there's two things going on. There's the fact that they already have a life-limiting illness, and then they have this thing that is universal. Suddenly, it's, I mean, life and death is universal, but it's universal.
No, I see what you're saying, because it's kind of like a pan society thing, isn't it? It's kind of like all the media stuff coming in. I'm like, is it right to say it like takes away your own special experience? Kind of, I don't know. I mean. Mm. We did have, I remember very early on, one of the first people we had that tested positive for COVID actually said, oh, thank God, at least I can go now. It was like she was an elderly lady who totally accepted that it was her time. And yet she wasn't, you know, some people, that's how they feel, isn't it, as they're approaching the end. She was just ready. She's just ready. Take me, is what she said every day. And she got tested positive for COVID and she said, hallelujah, that's it, you know, I won't have long to wait now.
Did she survive and come out?
She survived and came out. And people, I think, have been, you know, the whole thing of having COVID on your death certificate, it's like that has been an issue for people as well, I think. People have said they, you know, they want to acknowledge that their relative died of, I'm going to pick something out of the blue, you know, some sort of metastatic cancer rather than COVID. You know, it's almost like they want reassuring that what they've been living with or what that person has lived with and risen above and coped with and lived alongside for, you know, might even have been years for some people, or at least a few months. They've been dealing with this. It's been a part of their lives. I don't know. Is it because they want that acknowledged rather than just someone just writing COVID-19?
Right. Yeah.
That is purely anecdotal.
I mean, I've been not shocked, but I do, when I tell people, of course, you know, yes, this disease can prove fatal for people, but I don't know what the figures are. You might know them, if not figures, certainly get a sense more. But I get the sense that I'm going to say 50% of people, if not more, come out of our COVID wing, as it were, back into or more. I mean, whereas one might assume, my goodness, if comorbidities and vulnerabilities and age are confounding factors and are likely to amplify the effects of COVID, you think our cohort of patients would be really the ones that we need to super isolate and super separate and super look after. And yet they can get COVID. Some of them be really quite poorly symptomatically from it. Or the otherwise, or very little, and then come out again and survive. I mean, how would you say the figures were in terms of coming out?
No, I would agree with you. Again, no figures in front of me, but that's absolutely my sense, that more than 50% of people have come out of isolation. And maybe then some of those people have gone, well, yeah, and quite a number of those people will have then gone home.
My name is Robert Roy Hackett. I'll be 86 this July. I had the virus in December last year.
I wonder if you could talk us through the sort of run-up. How was it that you were found out to have COVID and what went on for you?
The first thing I had was a fall, and the ambulance team was sent for. And when they came, they examined me and said I needed to go into hospital because they thought I'd got COVID. They took me to hospital where I was put into accident and emergency to wait for tests. And I was there about 3/4 of an hour. And during that period, I had the most peculiar feelings passing through my mind. I really wanted to die. I'm sure it was the coronavirus that were generating it. And it was shocking. I felt as though I wanted to die and I'd had enough. Now, I know that were nonsense. I shouldn't be thinking them thoughts. So I worked on myself and switched them off and make myself think, no, I've got to live, and it's important that I do live. Then I was taken into the hospital itself, into a ward, where they treated me for the COVID. And I was there about 10 days, and the treatment and the way they treated me was brilliant. And after 10 days, I was let out and sent home. I could relax and everything came back to normality, which was beautiful. I normally keep quite positive, and I've managed to, with the support of the staff, do that. They treated me marvellously. And then when I came back to this flat, I was given therapy and help, which has been marvellous. So those thoughts have gone, and I'm thinking positively again. And I would hope that other people in a similar situation do their best to keep positive. By and large, I've been very lucky.
Do you think the hospice has learnt anything through COVID?
I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, isn't it? But, you know, working together and, you know, sort of teamwork type things is, you know, we've had to do that a lot. And, you know, being trying to understand why someone might see things differently from you. I know we should always be doing that, but, you know, this has been a particular time, I think, where, you know, we all come into this with our own baggage and our own life experience, don't we? And we all get very involved in wanting to do the right thing for our patients. And what might have been good for our individual patients when we're doing our nice palliative individualised care might not be the right thing for society. And, you know, we all stand very differently on that. We're all on a scale in that, aren't we? I don't know. I don't even know where I see myself on that scale. I don't know where you see yourself. But, you know, it has been, I'm going to say conflict, but, you know, that's been something we've had to reconcile between ourselves on a daily basis. And maybe we've learned through sort of doing that to listen to each other a bit more. So, yeah, I think as a team, we've worked together really well. You know, here on the inpatient unit, for example, you know, there's a great team of healthcare assistants, nurses, the physios, the OTs who have been around, you know, with people. You know, it's been really something that's helped carry us through. And I think together we've supported each other pretty well.
My name is Hannah Botsford. I've been a healthcare assistant at Ashgate Hospice for 3 years.
I hate living on Main Road. It's so annoying.
For a third of your time at Ashgate, you've been working under quite the most extraordinary conditions any of us have ever known, not only at work, but in our own individual lives. These are unique and unprecedented times, as we hear many times, but they really are. I mean, they really, really are. I mean, for you personally, and then we'll look at maybe what it's like at the ward. How would you characterise this year just for Hannah and Hannah's life? How has it been?
It's been really hard in the fact of one day we came into work and everything was normal. The next day we're having to wear masks to go into rooms. Then we're going to have to wear masks all the time. Then it was like, right, you've got to put all of this on and then you've got to take that bed into quarantine. It was like a barrage of information. So many things that we had to do different that we had no idea. I mean, I definitely had no idea. All the new information, the policies, the procedures were mind-boggling.
Particularly early on when everyone was finding their feet about what do I put on first, doffing and donning, and all of those things that we had to kind of get up to speed with. Do you think there was a sense of, or rather, what was your sense of going into, when you were first going into those patients who'd come in and had either tested positive or came in having tested positive? From a personal
panic.
Point of view, a bit panic.
I panicked. I think in the beginning, because it was all very like new and fresh, everyone didn't know what they were up against, petrified of catching it. As time's gone on, because we know more about what we're doing and we know more about our PPE and we know what to do now. And for me, the nerves aren't as bad. you know, it's just making sure I've washed my hands properly, I'm for long enough, I've taken everything off correctly, because apparently there's a way to take off gloves. Who would have thought?
We had to reduce the amount of family members that could visit. Now, as a principle, the hospice has always essentially let anyone come any time of the day and almost any numbers, really.
Yeah, I can remember going in rooms and we've had 13, 14 people in there.
Exactly. So this must have been a huge change. The people who were going in, as well as doing the tasks that they were charged to do, there was a kind of surrogacy of family. I mean, what did that feel like going in, knowing that, like you said, that was maybe you were going to be the person that they saw, that they weren't going to see their daughters or their sons or their wives or husbands or whoever?
It absolutely broke my heart. But for us to be able to build up that relationship and be able to be with them and care for them and love them like our own family, that's what we do, you know? I couldn't stand the thought of, you know, anyone being on their own, especially in that situation. I mean, it's bad enough being on your own anyway. Never mind being very poorly in a hospice, which is scary at the best of times. You know, the thoughts of hospices are, it's all about death. It's not. But, you know, the thoughts of going into a hospice is scary. And then in a pandemic, even more scary. Can't see my family. Even worse. So if I can crack a stupid joke and do a little dance in the room to make them laugh, it's a big responsibility, but I'll try.
Because also, I guess for those, the patients themselves, like you say, they're already, you know, at an extraordinarily difficult junction in their life. So for those that have come in and then transfer from, as it were, the normal side of the hospice onto the COVID side, how would they speak of that, the patients that you cared for who made that transition?
Yeah, they were scared, and they were especially upset when we said, you know, we've got to restrict your visitors even more because of the risk of COVID. Some of them were concerned about, like, their deaths being speeded up as well. You know, they thought, well, this is it, me now, I've got COVID. You know, we've had a lot of strong patients. They've made it through.
So they've come off of the COVID ward. They've been on it, essentially got over their COVID symptoms and then come back into the normal unit, is what you're saying?
Yeah, we've had a lot of survivors.
And do you think you've learned anything from your colleagues, the other nurses, the medics, dare I say it, the therapists? Do you think there's other things that you've learned from just working with other folk and watching them?
You always learn something new from working with someone new. Dr. Becky, I did a shift the other week and I said, come on, get your pinny on, get your gloves on, come work with me. And she was like, do you know what, I really wish we did this again. She said, you know, we go into our patients, we have a little talk and then we sort their meds out and that's it. And she's like, but you see them for 12 hours. You know them inside out. You know what? How they have the cup of tea, and you can take it without asking because you know they have one at 2 o'clock. And that's what I like about Ashgate. No one's above each other. We are all together.
In terms of COVID, Rebecca, just is there ways that it's directly affected you, either in terms of your work or has it impinged upon you in your private life at all?
What have I found most hard about this year? I mean, I suppose what I've found hard is, like, everything closes in on you, doesn't it? So, you know, a lot of the things that I would do to try and, I'm going to say switch off on work, but you know what I mean? Sort of things that I like to do outside of work that keep going, that are part of me kind of thing, you know, have, like, they go. And this is probably true for everybody. So it's that, like, working in a slightly more pressured situation with lots of anxiety, you know, lots of uncertainty around you, seeing people, you know, in really tricky situations, you know, and trying to sort of put that in a compartment for a while and do something else to kind of rejuvenate yourself. Those sort of things and the possibility of those things have just not been there. So I don't know. I like to go on trips. I call them trips, but I like to go on trips. You know, I like to go to new places. I like to, you know, I've got quite a lot of friends who live in, you know, far-flung places. And I like to know that if I really needed to, I could go and have an adventure, or, you know, that that's a possibility. And that is not. And as the years gone on, it's become more like, oh, you know, when will that sort of ever happen? And, you know, you know, my family live away, and, you know, they've fortunately been well, and they've, you know, they've kept themselves positive and all that. But, you know, knowing that, you know, actually, if bad things happen, there's going to be a lot of risk assessment to do before you can actually do all those normal things.
You're going to need a travel SOP, aren't you?
A travel SOP. Oh, my goodness.
You need a travel SOP. I can see one coming. You need a travel SOP.
Hey, because even in our world, can SOP remain sort of bread dipped in unpasteurised cow's milk?
Actually, yeah, I can write one of those for you if you want. Rebecca, I'm just going to move it on a little bit. There is a question that we've asked everyone on this series. It's a question you can bounce back at me or not answer, or say what you want. It's really whether working in palliative care has changed views about your own mortality. Do you reflect on your own mortality? Does the work force that on you? And have those reflections altered over time?
So I'm quite simple. So I sometimes, you know, you meet somebody and sometimes you think, do you know what? If I was facing what that person is facing, I really hope I can do it in that manner. So I suppose if that's a way of sort of thinking about your own mortality.
Well, an interesting point, the thing of those reflections, when you see someone managing their death with some degree of openness and acceptance in a full sense and a position of peace around it, there is a I too take a lot of comfort from that, and I am always impressed, even with those who seem to struggle with it, as it were, you know, like really rail against it. There often is a point of peace, even if it's right at the very end, even if it's just those last few moments, where something in us goes, like just that full acceptance. And I too reflect and think, I don't know how I would be. I can think, I can reflect on it, and I do reflect on mortality, and I really try and push it. I really try and think about it sometimes as a practice. And yet I know that none of that is meaningful until I'm there.
Do you know what? I have this idea. I saw this little quote once. We were on holiday in Iceland, and it was from one of these big Icelandic sagas. And it was this little poem from back in the day, and this guy gets wheeled out of his shack or whatever he was in, some chieftain, and he turns his face to the sun and he says, right now is the time. And I sort of have this idea that, you know, when it's my turn, you can wheel me out, I'll feel the sun full on my face, no fear, bye chaps. That'll be me.
Absolutely.
I sort of think, oh, there you go, feel the sun on your face. And but then you know, we see the sort of the months, or sometimes years, sometimes weeks, in the run-up to that. And it's all very well to think, oh, at that moment, yeah, come death, whatever. But it's dealing with the rest of it. And we see people having to do that, don't we? Crossing the grim borderline or whatever we talk about.
But and that's where the privilege again comes in for us. You know, when people say, how do you do your job?
I
think, God, how do you not do this job? It's an amazing job. It's an amazing job. Like, really, we're right at the sharp end of it all the time. And, you know, if we listened more, if I listened more, if I could listen more deeply, if I could be more attentive, maybe I would see all these gifts that I'm being given every single moment of my working day. I'm being given something about the nature of reality. So I think it's beautiful that you reflect thusly and take that confidence from people who are that bit further on this timeline than us.
You have been listening to the Life and Death Podcast with me, Stephen Rumford, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice Care. Thank you to Dr. Becky, Hannah, and of course, Roy, for chatting with me. And thank you very much for listening. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, you can head to our website, ashgatehospicecare.org.uk, for links and support. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
We'd love you to ask us any questions or share your experience of death and dying in your review, or let us know on our socials, Ashgate_hospice on Twitter and Ashgate Hospice Care on Instagram and Facebook.